Good morning, everybody. I'd like to call the meeting to order, and I'll begin by saying Happy New Year. Let's hope 2019 is a good one. So keeping with our usual practice, we're going to take public comments on each agenda item, and there will be a three-minute time limit for each speaker. Anyone wishing to comment on an agenda item should fill out a comment card and talk to Brianna Shoemaker, who's to your left down in the front. Executive Secretary Kimberly Muljet, can you call roll, please?
Commissioner Baker?
Here.
Commissioner Ball? Commissioner Byrne?
Here.
Commissioner Curtin? Commissioner Del Bosque?
Here.
Commissioner Herrera?
Here.
Commissioner Keg?
Here.
Commissioner Quintero?
Here. Thank you. We will not be holding a closed session item today. So the next item on the agenda is the approval of the December 19th meeting minutes. Are there any changes? Any motion for approval?
So moved.
Second. Okay. Roll call vote, please.
Commissioner Baker?
Aye.
Commissioner Byrne?
Aye.
Commissioner Del Bosque?
Aye.
Commissioner Herrera?
Aye.
Commissioner Keg?
Aye.
Commissioner Quintero.
Aye. Thank you. Executive Officer's report.
Good morning, Commissioners.
Morning.
I've got several things I'd like to talk to you about this morning. I did present some information on the Water Storage Investment Program to the Water Advisory Committee of Orange County in early January, and that talk went very well. In your packets this morning, you have a notification. And this notification was received January 7th from DWR, and it is notifying the Commission of a shift in the Salton Sea New River West Design Build Project. We were notified of the New River West Design Build Project in June of 2017. Since that time, this project is being rolled into a larger design build project called the Species Conservation Habitat Project. So it's being rolled into a larger project, so they re-notified us, and that notification is in your packet. I would anticipate hearing more about the project once the contractor is selected, and that is likely to be completed in approximately a year. So sometime around January 2020, they may be coming in and explaining that project a little further for you. So that's what that notification is. A little update for you on some of the strategic plan work in previous meetings. Was there a question? Or
Commissioner Byrne.
I have a really quick question. It seems kind of unique for the public contracting code to have a notification provision for us. Is that something that is another, or is it not unique?
It's specifically around the design build authority that was given to DWR for the Salton Sea.
I get it.
For that issue, and then and I think it's because the Water Commission serves kind of as that public board for DWR.
So it's most. So if we're DWR is exercising design build, then like you said, specific to Salton Sea, they have to inform us. Okay, but not necessarily design build for other types of projects. Or
I think that's the only design build authority they have.
Okay. Right. Thank you. Sorry, more curiosity.
No problem. Previously, the commission decided that it's time to work on our strategic plan this year, and so the chair and vice chair have been working with myself and Jennifer Ruffalo, the assistant executive officer, on that process. I just wanted to give you a short update on that. Part of the framework that we're working through in order to update the strategic plan has us looking at internal and external relationships or environments, so we have an understanding of how we operate before we really get into the mission, the vision, and the goals for the strategic plan. And so really what that boils down to for us right now is really working with the DWR in terms of the relationship between the Water Commission and DWR. So we have met with the director. We are working with looking at that advisory capacity that we have in the statute and saying, how do we make this relationship more functional and a little bit more solid? Then that will move us in a direction of identifying certain items or work pieces that the commission can really start working with. Of course, the other piece out there externally to us is the change in administration. So as the administration populates some of the positions that they need to, we'll get a better feel for where we're headed with that as well. In terms of the water storage investment program, I just wanted to touch quickly on the interagency work group. We have been meeting with the administering agencies, CDFW, State Board, and DWR, for a while now. And we've been looking at what it means in terms of the public benefits claimed in the applications and trying to, what does it really mean to kind of start actualizing and figuring out how we do the administration of public benefit contracts. So all that work has led us to the February meetings that I talked about a little bit last time, where we are going to be meeting with applicants in February. Those official announcement for those meetings will come out shortly. And really, it's orientation time for applicants and agencies so we can talk a little bit more directly about what is it going to take from the agency's perspective for an applicant to start providing information that will inform the contract. Where are we on timing and permit processes? And what can applicants expect in terms of working? How do they work with the different agencies? All of that. So this is really, February will be kind of the orientation time to kind of start this whole process. So that is all happening. In terms of other aspects of the water storage investment program, we do have two early funding agreements executed and are working with those I guess we'd call them grantees or funding recipients at this point, on those contracts. We're still working with the third to get that executed. And just as a reminder, at the end of January, we are expecting the quarterly reports that all eight applicants must submit to give us an update on how they are progressing with the requirements in the statute.
Joe, can you tell us who you have executed contracts with and then who the third one is in the process?
So both Contra Costa and Santa Clara Valley Water District have executed the agreements. We are working with sites as the third, and they are working on scope and things like that still.
Commissioner Herrera.
Have any of the applicants, the project proponents, have they submitted any invoices?
We currently have one invoice that we are working on. We don't have a complete invoice yet, so we are working with the applicant, and they're working on that package.
Yeah, at the last meeting, Commissioner Ball was anxious to hear us announce that there's money going out the door, so that'll be good news when it happens.
Right. Yeah. And we are working on that.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Okay, Commissioner Byrne.
So, Joe, what happens if we get the progress reports and they're not progressing well? Obviously, you're going to communicate with them and try to help them and move them forward.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's probably what you're going to get to when you're talking about in February as far as the timeline and schedule and decisions of...
Right. So you, as the commission, have the discretion, if one of the applicants is not progressing, to rescind your MCED decision of June and move forward. There is a statutory deadline for all applicants, and they must have some interim product. That's what I call it. They have to have their draft CEQA document out for public review. They have to have a 75% commitment on the non-program funding portion. And that is January 2022, which is still kind of out in the distance. So, you know, the commission, as we look at the quarterly reports and we report back to the commission, that's all stuff that you will have to consider. And when is the appropriate time when somebody is really not progressing? Certainly, I think with a lot of these efforts that are ongoing in the preparatory phases, when you look at the timelines we've already put out on the website from the initial quarterly report, some of them are pretty long. And so I think that the way that the schedules are currently structured, you'll see activity 2021-2022 before you really get to that point where you can tell if things are going well or not going well for some of these projects.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. I think I'm done.
Okay. Thank you. are there any public comments on the items that we just discussed? Okay. Seeing none, we'll move to commission member reports, and I'll start with Commissioner Byrne. Commissioner Baker? Mr. Del Bosque? Herrera? Okay. No, and I don't have anything to report either. Okay. at this time, we'll take public comments on items that are not on the agenda. And just as a reminder, public comments are limited to 3 minutes. And we understand that DWR released final groundwater basin priorities for most of the groundwater basins in the state on January 4th. Anyone who may be commenting on those basin priorities or other subjects not on our agenda, please come up to the podium if that's what you're here to talk about. If you'd like to speak on a specific agendized item, please fill out a public comment card and turn it in to Brianna, commission staff, and she's down at the front and your left. In the event that anyone wants to comment on the final Sigma Basin prioritization decisions that were released on January 4th, you might want to, we'll see if anybody has any comments there. So any public comments? Okay, seeing none, we'll move to item number 8, which is the election of the commission chair and vice chair. It's that time of year. So I will now accept nominations for the commission's chair and vice chair for 2019.
Do we need to make the motion separately, that it's chair as one motion and vice chair as another motion?
I think we could do it together.
No, I think last year you did a combined motion.
Okay. I'd like to nominate Commissioner Quintero for chair and Commissioner Baker for vice chair.
Are there any other nominations? Okay. Is there any discussion?
I'll second.
Okay. Is there any public comment on these nominations?
The only discussion I would say is I think you've done a great job, Armando and Carol, and thank you. And I haven't heard that anyone else is really interested, so I would think we'd continue with the same group. But I did want to say that it was a challenging year and a half or 2 years, and I thought that you both did a very nice job. And I see no reason, absent someone else wanting to take a turn or something, which I haven't heard, to have you guys continue for continuity. And
thanks for that. But I have to say that there is no way that we could have done this job without the team in the Water Commission staff, who've been just extraordinary in the last few years, as well as all the department staff from DWR, State Water Resources Control Board, and Fish and Wildlife. Really, our job was made easier, much easier because of you. And I really appreciate the wisdom, really, that all of you have and what you bring in the planning and the execution of these meetings. Thanks so much. So having said that, thanks, Joe. Is there a motion? So we have a
motion
and a second. So, Ms. Moljet, could you please call the roll?
Commissioner Baker?
Aye.
Commissioner Ball? Commissioner Byrne?
Aye.
Commissioner Curtin? Commissioner Del Bosque?
Aye.
Commissioner Herrera?
Aye.
Commissioner Keg?
Aye.
Commissioner Quintero?
Aye. Thank you. And I forgot to mention the commission. the commission has been great. I mean, really, we've been in some really tough discussions and public meetings. And for those of you who've participated in those, I have really appreciated the focus that all of you have had, even the folks who were, and including the folks who are not here. And it's been really wonderful in terms of how the commission has interacted with the public, with staff. And I think sort of a larger team. We've dealt with some really tough issues, and we did okay. And so thank you to my colleagues. And thanks for your trust in asking Carol and I to be in these roles again. Okay. So the item number 9 is the State Water Project Dam Safety Update. And since the 2017 Orville Spillway incident, DWR has assessed the condition of many of the dams and spillways within the State Water Project. The department has also evaluated its dam safety program, and here to brief us today on the safety program and condition assessments are Ted Craddock, who is the Assistant Deputy Director for the State Water Project, and David Sarkissian, who is the Dam Safety Engineer for the State Water Project. Welcome, gentlemen. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. Well, good morning, Commissioners. It's good to see you all again. So this will be a presentation, or what we're planning to do today is a briefing, which is really a follow-up to the high-level overview we provided last year that described the different initiatives we were embarked upon to basically enhance the State Water Project's dam safety program. So we've made good progress on that this past year. We have a work plan moving forward. We have a good team in place that has been doing over the many years good work, and we're looking to the future of this program. As you mentioned, joined here today with our Chief Dam Safety Engineer, David Sarkissian. So he's going to really provide an overview of much of the detail of the program, and then we'll both be here to answer any questions you have at the end. So at this point, I'll turn it over to David.
Thank you, Ted, and thank you for the invitation to present. We've been pretty busy, and so I was going to walk you through a little bit of background on the program and then what we've been up to lately. We've had an existing State Water Project Dam Safety Program in place for years, and that existing multi-layered approach kind of has these six pillars within it. Original design and construction measures. So when our State Water Project dams were designed and constructed, they did include a number of safety measures in terms of drains and instrumentation and things like that to monitor the safety of the dams. We also have what we call dam safety surveillance and monitoring plans in place, and these describe all the instrumentation and surveillance that's conducted for each dam. And our engineers here in Sacramento prepare those and share those with the field divisions, which ultimately implement the plans. Also, we have the Part 12D safety inspections, and that's from a FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission regulation, and the Director Safety Review Board, which is a California Water Code requirement, to retain a board of consultants every 5 years and have them perform an independent inspection and review of our dams. And so that's been in place since the dams were constructed. We also have emergency action plans and exercises for the dams. And then, of course, there's the routine maintenance conducted by the field divisions on the State Water Project dams. And lastly, capital improvements when there's a need for a major retrofit or refurbishment or perhaps an enlargement to a dam. That's another component to the program. So following the Oroville incident, we did undertake a number of program reviews to identify opportunities to improve the program. And we affectionately call these the five swim lanes, five efforts that were conducted to really look for ways to improve the program. The first one, self-assessment with CIADI Dam Safety Program Maturity Matrix. CIADI is a international organization, the Center for Energy Advancement and Technological Innovation, and it's a utility-driven organization with a dam safety interest group, and it's a venue where dam owners can go and communicate, learn from each other, and really explore opportunities to collaborate. And they have a maturity matrix where one can evaluate, kind of do a self-evaluation of the program. So we use that tool internally to take a look at ourselves. We also had the International Standards Organization 55001 ASDSO peer review, and the ASDSO is the Association of State Dam Safety Officials. We paired some asset management experts with dam safety experts and had them take a look at our program and interview people and look at our processes and procedures for areas of potential improvement. Our management also visited the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation and Southern California Edison to discuss their dam safety programs to see what we could learn from them. We also had an owner's dam safety program independent review, and this once again was external experts taking a look at our program and interviewing quite a wide range of our engineers and operators to get a sense of the program. And then lastly, of course, the independent forensic report, which came out from the Oroville incident. All five of these efforts generated quite a number of items that we need to consider to improve the program. And we saw quite a number of commonalities of areas of enhancement. The first being getting a dam safety policy put in place or really updated for the State Water Project Dam Safety Program. We had what we call REM 16A, and that's the REMs are water resource engineering memorandums that are kind of like policies for the department. And so we identified that we needed to update that policy, and I was happy to see that that's included in the handout. We identified the need for enhanced top-down leadership structure, more training and interaction with other dam safety organizations, a need for cross-divisional dam safety teams. So this is really internal, getting the communication going, getting the collaboration going between our different divisions within the State Water Project and DWR. Linking the dam safety program with the O&M asset management program, which was an existing program, I think started around 2016 or so. And there's a lot of commonalities. A lot of work's been done by the asset management program that we can kind of leverage to accelerate our improvement of the dam safety program. And lastly, generating this culture of continuous improvement across all parts of the dam safety program, and recognizing that it really touches, our dam safety program is really reliant on the efforts of quite a number of employees within DWR across many divisions. This graphic illustrates kind of where we want to go in terms of dam safety, and it's really, I think, anchors to some of these asset management principles we've been exploring. You can see in the bottom left, standard practice is where probably most dam safety programs are today. And we have really a concerted effort and management support to really enhance the program and get us up into that zone of good practice. And you can see we've got some of the reviews listed there as the means of identifying how we can improve the program and getting to that area of good practice. And then I think continuous improving, and when we ultimately get to good practice, making those decisions about in what areas do we want to get to best practice and become leaders in dam safety. And that is really, I think, where the department is heading, and it'll take time, but that's, I think, on all of our minds internally. The dam safety policy was a big first step for us to collaborate internally and really come to agreement on roles and responsibilities for the dam safety program, and really making sure we've got that top-down leadership in place and communicated internally to ourselves. The policy also establishes the program elements, which kind of harkens back to the asset management world, where you define program elements and you try and enhance all of those over time to make a holistic approach to dam safety or asset management. And we got that executed by the director back in November. So we're really happy to have this under accomplished and as a guiding policy for us moving forward. Within the policy, there are the program elements. And some of these kind of sound familiar to what I presented in that earlier slide as just fundamental things we've been doing all along. The idea being that we may have been doing it, but we can enhance it. We can improve it. So surveillance in terms of having boots on the ground, collecting data and eyes on the dams. Dam safety assessments would include ourselves, our engineers taking a look at the dams and continuously considering the data coming in and evaluating their safety and performance. Reservoir operations, how are we operating the dams? Maintenance, improving our maintenance across all pieces of the dam, including, of course, spillways, but there's a lot of critical and pertinent structures that we need to be maintaining at each dam. Design and construction, making sure that we're bringing in best practices in future designs and or rehabilitation to the dams. Risk management, which is one of the efforts the asset management program has already broken a lot of ground on, and incorporating risk into our planning and prioritization of dam safety projects. emergency preparedness involves the emergency action plans, EAPs, as well as inundation mapping, and also engaging with the emergency management agencies, making sure that our EAPs are usable documents for them and that they understand their roles and responsibilities. Independent reviews, so this would tie back to the Part 12 safety inspections and Director Safety Review Boards, where we ask a group of external experts to take a look at our dams and provide us with recommendations and priorities. Project delivery, in terms of executing our dam safety projects on time, on budget. Communication, making sure both internal communication is strong in terms of priorities, but also communicating to the public and stakeholders the nature and projects underway at our dams. Documentation, this relates to our internal records, making sure that they're complete, they're organized, and they're available for those experts to come in and review. Technical expertise is tied to training, of course, identifying core competencies for our staff and bringing the training necessary to improve their skills, and also, when needed, going to the outside industry and bringing in that expertise. And lastly, program reviews, providing management with the information they need to assess where the program's at, where we need to improve, where we need to invest. So 2018, we were quite busy with quite a number of things. These bullets are just kind of highlights of many of the activities that were underway. We enhanced that executive level accountability through our dam safety policy. We elevated the position which I hold at this time to a principal engineer level, which internally just helps enhance the ability to reach out to other divisions and get work done. We established the SWP Dam Safety Program Steering Committee, of which Mr. Craddock's a part, and we've been meeting every 2 weeks, and it provides me a venue to bring issues directly to management and get their support and resources as needed to address issues. We have reorganized and expanded our O&M, Operations and Maintenance, Dam Safety Branch. We're now called Dam Safety Services, and we're expanding slowly over time as we are ramping up and taking on more work. We've executed training contracts with the Association of American Society of Civil Engineers and ASDSO. And what's nice about those is we're able to have training brought to us, which is really convenient because we can really get a lot of efficiencies that way. Enhancing the training plans for engineers. We've worked with CalHR to improve recruitment and increase participation with dam safety industry, and that's going to conferences, presenting abstracts or PowerPoints to our peers and learning from them as well. Increased use of external dam safety experts, and we've done quite a bit of that through consultants and through partnerships with the Army Corps of Engineers and Reclamation. And then lastly, outreach to local agencies in regards to our EAPs, emergency preparedness, and we've had a number of exercises in 2018 to do that. In regards to spillways, over 2017-2018, we've been very busy there as well. We've completed what we called our Phase 1 spillway inspections and condition assessments and some maintenance actions for Pyramid, Castaic, Cedar Springs, Grizzly Valley, Frenchman Dam, Antelope Dam, and Del Valle Dam. And the photos there, the one in the middle of the page is a rope access inspection of Pyramid's spillway. So a lot of these inspections, They're tough to get to. There's a lot of safety planning involved and a lot of external expertise to bring in and get close and up close and personal with these spillways. The photo on the right is a maintenance action we accomplished at Del Valle's stilling basin. It's basically the outlet works for Del Valle Dam. So we've had right behind the inspections, we immediately retained contractors to perform maintenance actions at those spillways that where they were deemed necessary. In terms of 2019, quite a bit of work also planned. We have the Orville facilities potential failure mode analysis level 2 risk assessment workshops underway. And actually just this week, they did a site visit with the team. And then over the next couple weeks, they'll be having workshops to perform a potential failure mode analysis and taking the next step to take those failure modes and assess the risk to each one. And that's going to really help us prioritize how to move forward in terms of projects and as well as surveillance in terms of new instrumentation. There's the Orville Dam Safety Comprehensive Needs Assessment. That's been ongoing, quite a bit of effort there too. And the first bullet in terms of the PFMA and level two risk is really going to help inform that project as well and really make sure that any sort of measures developed under the Comprehensive Needs Assessment project, we can really measure the risk reduction achieved by each measure and each investment. Phase 1B spillways inspections. These would be all the spillways that were not necessarily identified by the Division of Safety of Dams or FERC. We still have other spillways that we would like to inspect to make sure we have a robust inspection record on report on record and follow up with any necessary maintenance. Phase 2 spillway invasive investigations. As thorough as our Phase 1 investigations are, there are still some things we just can't get to, and it actually requires some destructive testing or invasive testing and inspection. And so that will be kicked off in 2019. We've been working quite a bit on inundation mapping and EAPs as well, and exercises. As Mr. Craddock mentioned, we have also some initiatives, programmatic initiatives planned that will be kicking off in 2019 to improve the program. And then the last bullet, this continued alignment with the asset management program is really going to be a catalyst for our dam safety program to make some great progress here in the near term. Any questions?
Commissioner Kaag?
Thank you very, very much for being here and giving us all this information today. A couple things for me, just based on my background. I love the statement, culture of continuous improvement. And I'm hoping that all of the things that came before that you anticipate are going to help move the continuous improvement along. Awesome. And can you talk a little bit more about the recruitment part of this, that you said you were working with CalHR to improve improvement in recruitment? What did that entail?
Yeah, maybe I can start with that one, and then David could add to that. But so we looked at kind of a suite of, internally, a suite of activities that may help streamline and make some of our processes more efficient that will allow us to retain and recruit personnel. One area we saw is really critical is the exam process for our key engineering positions. And so working with CalHR in this case, we were able to develop online exams that will allow us then to bring in a greater pool of individuals to apply for our positions and make the process more efficient as well. So that's one example, and we have a few others that we're currently working on as well.
And you feel pretty good about that?
Yeah, I think that is something that's is actually being put into place right about this time this year, and so we've instituted online exams for our engineering entry level engineer positions and our environmental scientist positions, and found that to be very successful in helping us to bring in a greater pool and access to those engineering and technical resources throughout California and the United States. So that this is something that we see is going to be very helpful for us.
And are colleges part of that?
Colleges, we do have a college recruitment program that generally is a little more focused on our entry-level positions just because of the status of folks in college. So this is really focused on members of the industry or that are already out there in industry that may be looking for opportunities within okay. state government or in DWR specifically.
Okay, great. Thank you. And then finally, the internal external reviews, also in my experience, by having internal reviews, by knowing that there's going to be external reviews, the internal reviews become much more substantive, and it makes the external reviews go really well as well, and that ultimately providing pride in one's work, because I'm really sort of tired of government employees being trashed, and continuing that process of people really embracing their work and being proud of what they're proud of the work that they perform, I think is just excellent. Thank you very much.
Are there any other questions?
Ted, could you give the commission just a sense of how many dam spillways that your program is encompassing on the State Water Project? Because they'll be hearing from DSOD about other stuff later on, but this is specifically within the State Water Project, right?
Yeah, so I'll start and then pass it over to David. But we have, you know, on the order of 30 or so dams and reservoirs, and then David can talk specifically about, you know, the number of spillways we have of, you know, significance from a structural perspective.
Yeah, we've got seven significant spillways, and those were the ones identified by Division of Safety of Dams and FERC to go look at because of their commonalities in design with Oroville. So those were the top of the list, you know, the priorities. And as I mentioned before, we do have other spillways, so in total probably about 22 that we're going to be inspecting and performing maintenance on. And so it represents a significant amount of work, and the level of detail of the inspections is pretty impressive. And so it's a busy area of the program at this point in time.
Are there any other questions right now? Thank you for asking that, Joe. I have a couple observations and questions. One of them is, you know, you also talked about your improvement targets and getting to a best practice of asset lifecycle management, which really I think what you're practicing and what you're putting in place is through DSOD and others affecting all the reservoirs in the state, which is really critical. I serve on a water board in Marin County. We've got seven dams there. And so believe me, all of this has gotten the attention of water districts and water reservoir dam holders all over the state. A couple things. When you talked about the technology to monitor the dams, does that include things like remote cameras?
It does. You know, we have those up at Oroville, mm-hmm. and that's there's a lot of technology out there that we're thinking about and wanting to roll out. And it's just a matter of prioritizing those kind of efforts sure. with everything else. Yeah.
No, it's interesting because with the new fire threats that we're all facing, a lot of watershed managers are starting to put in these heat sensing remote cameras that are pretty incredible, and it makes sense. So I have my question also, I have a sort of a connected set of questions, and one of them is, you know, when you talk about dam safety and, you know, flood inundation maps and all of that, we're talking about the dam and downstream. So I'm curious about upstream and with regards to reservoir operations and dam operations, because I know that we are constrained by or guided by the rule curves in terms of when you have to release water at a certain date, at a certain level. And in the last several years, we've experienced cases where, because of rule curves, when we were in drought, there were reservoir operators that had to release water, anticipating that they, you know, preparing for a flood, basically. And I'm wondering, and then with Oroville, you know, part of the problem there was exactly what we're experiencing right now, which is we've got this atmospheric river coming across the Pacific. It's going to hit us this afternoon, and it's going to dump a ton of snow in the higher elevations, but there's a zone where it's going to be dropping water and snow. And, you know, so with the climate change that we're in, we're going to be getting more, we've talked about this in all areas, but we're going to be getting more runoff. And so is there any effort to work on sort of a modification of rule curves so that it's actually a better tool for water managers?
I can talk a little bit to that. So as part of the Oroville Comprehensive Needs Assessment, we have six major tracks we're looking at. And one of the tracks is the a review of the reservoir operations as we look at perhaps you know, additional work on the spillways or other type of work at Oroville. And so we do see that, because the water control manual, you know, was put together in the early 1970s, and based upon work in the 60s, and need to update that. So we've reached out to the Corps of Engineers to start the informal discussions on that topic, and the current work is focused a little more on near term reservoir operations. But I think we have started to engage them on looking at whether forecast and form operations make sense at Oroville, so that we've just started that dialogue and expect that you know, as we work through the comprehensive needs process, that'll initiate further work on that effort.
Yeah, that's great, because I think that the early information systems that'll really inform everybody from above the dams to the reservoir operations and even all the downstream, you know, water users. I mean, it seems like more and more in all cases, early and accurate information is good for everybody. So I also really am looking forward to that time when we can better anticipate the kinds of things that happened, you know, with Orville that didn't, you know what I mean. We just had this huge flood that we didn't expect, and that's a big part of it. Actually, I think that's it. Carol?
Go ahead.
Just a quick question. When we've been talking about dam safety, it seems like we're importantly focusing on the spillway and the operation of the reservoir. I was wondering, does the program also encompass all of the other related facilities like the electrical generation facilities, the forebay operations, or is that kind of a separate sort of inspection or prioritization?
Well, yeah, there are other pertinent structures that are included in the inspections, the physical inspections of the facilities. And then in terms of operation and maintenance, there's components to the program there as well. And those are handled by largely our mechanical and electrical engineers. So it really is, and in moving forward, trying to make the program more holistic and perhaps capture some of those elements that maybe haven't had as much attention, and making sure that they're part of this holistic program, looking at all parts of the infrastructure and the facility.
Commissioner DeVos.
Does this include San Luis, which is a joint facility?
Yeah, we operate and maintain the facilities while the reclamation's has the ownership. And so we do have DWR staff that are doing the inspections alongside reclamation engineers. And then our San Luis Field Division staff are collecting the instrumentation data and doing the routine surveillance of driving the dam and getting eyes on the dam. So, yeah, they're part of the program.
Thank you.
Commissioner Hedera, did you have something? So Carol's question reminded me of this. When is Thermalitos going to come back online? Do you know when that's going to happen?
I'm sorry, can you repeat
Thermalitos. Do you know when Thermalitos is going to come back online?
I think one unit in 2019.
Yeah, one unit is currently operational with a plan to engage the other units by about midpoint to this year. We can confirm the dates, but the latest briefing I got was on that.
No, it's great to hear that it's already, that the gates are open at least. Yeah, that's great. Thanks. Is there any public comment? I'm sorry, Commissioner Byrne.
Go quickly, and this is not necessarily your area of your responsibility, but are the feds doing the same thing that you're doing for their structures? Or since the Orville issue, I imagine that has it prompted them to, and is there information sharing, which it sounds like there is on San Luis at least?
Yeah, I haven't heard specifics on how perhaps like U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is approaching their spillways or reclamation. But I can tell you that certainly the Orville incident really was a wake-up call for all owners in terms of looking at their spillways and understanding the spillways and ensuring that we have a handle on the maintenance and the inspection and the surveillance. And it seems like every dam safety conference that comes along, spillways are a major component to the discussion, to the conference.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I'll maybe add, in some of the other forums we interact with the industry on, it has been a catalyst. We did hear as part of the ASDSO review team that looked at our program and the enhancements we're doing to our program that they really see that we're, you know, at that best practice with this work we're doing and see it as a real opportunity for us to share to others, you know, what a good program can look like. So I think there'll be some good opportunities with the broader industry with the work we're doing moving forward.
Thank you.
Great, thanks. Are there any public comments on this presentation or questions? Seeing none, gentlemen, thank you so much for the presentation and for being here this morning. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to move on to item 10, which is the AB 1755 Open Data Initiative. And is Christine McCready here? The Open and Transparent Water Data Act of 2016 requires several agencies, including DWR, to create an integrated water data platform by September 2019. The agencies must develop protocols for data sharing, documentation, quality control, public access, and decision support tools related to water data. Christine McCready, who is chief of DWR's Integrated Data and Analysis Branch, is here to tell us the status of the Open Data Initiative. Thank you so much for being here this morning.
Well, thank you, commissioners, for inviting me to speak with you. I am, as you said, Chris McCready, and it's my pleasure to update you today. With a little assist. And I may be joined by David Harris, who works with the California Natural Resources Agency, who's been one of our many very active and effective supporters and partners. So that said, just give me a second to advance. I'm sorry, just the arrow forward.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Pretty easy, I guess. I want to start by saying there is just so much to talk about when it comes to AB 1755 that I'll do my very best to stay at a high level and try and set context for you. And then I will let your questions and comments sort of guide where we go with the presentation. In particular, I'd invite you to interrupt me if there are questions of clarification. And, of course, we'll have time at the end for discussion as well. So with that, I'll get going. First, I'll cover for you just a quick run-through on the black and white of the legislation. So in September of 2016, Assemblymember Dodd put forth at that time, our Governor Brown signed into law the legislation that Assemblymember Dodd put forth. And this is essentially focused on not just making data available, open and transparent, but also with a focus on interagency cooperation, opportunities for innovation. But we'll get into the inspiration behind this momentarily. There were some deadlines expressed in the legislation. First of them was January 2018, when the department was, with its partners, meant to produce a strategic plan for data management to guide how we implement AB 1755, and also a shot at protocols that would be developed to support data publication, access, quality control, et cetera. There was a deadline expressed for April 2018 also having to do with requests for a proposal, and DWR and its partners opted not to do any RFPs, no need to build something new. In September of this year, then, we have an obligation to make available a number of data sets that I'll show you in a moment. We are meant to make those available by September, and those that are not available at that point, or anything new that comes along, is meant to be updated quarterly thereafter. And then 11 months later, next year in August, we have an obligation to make some additional data sets available centering around federal data that has to do with California's water resources circumstance. Similarly, that data is meant to be made available and updated on a quarterly basis. We are focusing first at DWR with our partners on the data sets described here in Section 12.4.15. State water project reservoir operations, groundwater levels, urban water use, and land use. We also have a great partner in the state board, and they're working very hard on making their water rights, water diversions, and water quality data available on the platforms. And finally, Fish and Wildlife, who has been actively putting data up and making it available for years, but they're working to make their data available in this construct on fish abundance and distribution. So I mentioned federal data sets. Here's a brief listing of them. Stream flow conditions through the National Water Information System. Also federal Central Valley Flood Project. I'm sorry, Central Valley Project Operations, and also U.S. Fish and Wildlife Fisheries and other fisheries data from other federal agencies. Let me see. I would like to take a moment to highlight what's shown here on the screen with item C. There was a foundation in the legislation really was we were in deep into a drought, many, many years of drought, and there was a desire to make transfers, you know, to support and facilitate transfers and exchanges so that we could ease drought conditions throughout the state. And so that was actually one of the mobilizing considerations when the legislation went through. It is something that we're interested in doing, but it is obviously less of an issue at the moment, but is something that we want to work toward. And water transfers and exchanges are of keen interest, especially in times of shortage. So we will move in that direction. Now that we've talked about the the black and white of the legislation, let's talk a little bit about what motivates things. So there is an expression of open data. It's a term that people use casually and with some flexibility. We have definitely in our research found a number of definitions that are available to describe what open data means. We have not as a state adopted one officially. However, our California Government Operations Agency is actively working on open data policy and will adopt a definition soon. But if I were to highlight for you the kind of words that show up frequently in all these various definitions, they have to do with not having a restriction or not having many restrictions on the use of data, that they are available in the public domain, and that the only requirement for use really is attribution and a share-alike philosophy. So the World Bank calls out some two dimensions of data openness, and I just want to highlight them for you. One, of course, would be obviously legally open, that it's placed in the public domain or under liberal terms of use with minimal restriction. But there's also this perspective about technically open. And what that means is that data are published in electronic format, machine-readable, non-proprietary, so that anyone can access them. And so we talk about that because our history of collecting data is not just since technology took up activities. So we have in the agencies a range of data locations, including Excel files on someone's hard drive. There might be in some of the older institutions boxes of data, graphics, so, you know, charts. So we are recognizing that data readiness is a process, and it's something that we'll be always working toward. We'll be transforming data as we can. But this machine readability obviously would make searching much easier and more reasonable for folks who are interested in what we're up to. So that said, I'll move on. We and in the state agencies who are implementing AB 1755 are really embracing what we see as the spirit of it, which is about fostering collaboration, creating opportunities to share and integrate, to work together, to minimize duplication in effort, and perhaps free up some of our staff who are collecting data to spend a little more time on data analysis so that we can draw new conclusions and identify new solutions. We are improving our water resources management. That's really at the bottom line for 1755. And, of course, transparency and accountability as government agencies, these are important to us. So I wanted to take a moment to talk about our partner agency team. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the existence of it, but because the legislation called out four agencies, and they're the top four bullets there, DWR, the boards, Fish and Wildlife, and also the California Water Quality Monitoring Council, we're obviously working together to make 1755 happen, but we're also really happy to be joined by strong support from the Governor's Office of Planning and Research, the Natural Resources Agency, which I mentioned earlier. We've been fortunate to have a great partner there. The Government Operations Agency, whom I mentioned moments ago, and we'll be talking about a little bit more, and the Delta Stewardship Council. So these eight agencies have thrown in together and are operating, I like to say, kind of like a family. It's a really productive relationship. There's not always agreement, but there's healthy disagreement and a lot of discussion. And I like to think so far what we've seen a lot of is a willingness to work through until we get to good answers to our questions. So it's it's a partnership I'm happy to be a part of, and it really does fuel the enthusiasm that I feel for the project, and I think we all feel that way. We also have, outside of the partner agency team, a lot of great support that we've received from our research sector. So that counts the California Council on Science and Technology. They've been wonderful. UC Water, and also the national labs. And we'll talk a little bit more as we go about what role those folks have played. I have this graphic, which I won't belabor, but I wanted to just show you that there's a full complement of activities that are happening in support of 1755. The two blue puzzle pieces, the strategic plan and the protocols, are those that were required by legislation. But around the sides in the green puzzle piece pictures are complementary activities that are informing what we're doing. They've informed those products that are shown in blue. And they're also informing how we move forward together. So we'll be talking about each of those pieces in their turn as we go along. Ultimately, though, of course, our goal is to move toward federated interoperable portals. I will get to that. And we're also obviously, again, embracing the spirit of 1755, which really means that we're looking for getting to a point of having useful data to support sustainable water management. So we released our strategic plan back in January of 2018, and then we refreshed it already in April of 2018. There we articulated our vision, which I just sort of alluded to, and we also expressed a few goals. And they are simply put, not necessarily simply accomplished, but we are looking for data to be sufficient, accessible, useful, and used. And those terms will come up as I go along. We also released some initial protocols, and we want to make sure that everyone understands that those protocols are going to be a living document. And I suspect that most of you have some kind of a contextual concept of what protocols are, you know, like when you meet the Queen. You're not supposed to stick out your hand to shake hands or whatever. Well, there are protocols that have to do with behaviors that are expected of people who publish data. Certain expectations of people who use that data. And also there are protocols that are more technical in nature that have to do with how the platforms will talk to one another or how data sets will interplay. So protocols has a broad definition in this context, but we are starting with as few as possible with the idea that, A, you know, you turn a big ship around slowly. People are used to doing what they're used to doing, and so we want to encourage and attract participation by those who have options. Some of us are beholden by the legislation to make data available, but others will have the opportunity, and we really hope to attract their interest. So we're starting with a very small nugget of protocols. We'll be exercising those and considering additions and augmentations in the near future, and we'll talk about that. But they are simply stated here. And let's see, the protocols in particular were partly informed by a document that was produced adjacent to our 1755 activities by somebody at UC San Diego Supercomputer, with a lot of our participation as well as some other nationwide experts in the data science world. But it is an expression of system requirements, essentially what does a business owner need to make this thing work for them? And then that backs into functional requirements, so sort of what does the system have to do to give that business owner what they're looking for? And then that would further pave a way into technical requirements, which gets down to specifications for data storage or data networking, et cetera. So it's a complicated web, but it's moving along quickly. Relatively quickly, I should say. So when I mentioned earlier that in April of 2018, we had an obligation, if there were going to be a release of a request for proposal, that we do it by then. And we opted, as I said, not to do that. And the reason for that, there are a couple of reasons, but one of the most important reasons is that there was already in play a data.ca.gov or open data portal that's hosted by our California Government Operations Agency. And from here forward, I'm going to call them GovOps. but GovOps had established this data portal that actually fields, not just water and ecological data like 1755 requires, but also health data and data on prisons and other data of concern that are related to the daily operations of our state. And so they've been actively working on that and making that data available. And alongside them, the State Water Resources Control Board had been actively working to make their own data available through that platform. Sort of in parallel, the CNRA, California Natural Resources Agency, had made available or was in the process of making available data.cnra.ca.gov, which we're calling the CNRA platform. And that platform is equally powerful. It's focused, it's our CNRA sister agencies are actually directed to make our data available there. So we're working that direction as quickly as we can. But necessarily, again, what the legislation calls for is sort of, if you will, I always do air quotes, a statewide integrated water data platform. And we agree with the philosophy, but rather than build one new warehouse of data, what we'd like to do instead is allow different portals, different platforms that already exist to play well together. And so we're really focusing more on this concept of federation. And now I'll break a little bit to explain federation, as we always do. You might think of it something like if you walk into your local library and you're looking for resources by a certain author or on a certain topic, you would approach what is now a virtual card catalog, and you would look up to see what kinds of resources are available to you on that topic or by that author or whatever, and then you would be aware of what you could borrow. Now, interlibrary loan systems would suggest that you might have to travel to a neighboring library that's participating or that they would send those materials to you. Today, obviously, with the advent and heavy use and success of our internet, then we have a web-based option that means you don't even have to wait. But the focus here is on the discoverability of that data, being able to be aware of its existence and then to pursue capturing it is exactly what we hope to do with federation. So we are working hard to make sure that these two portals talk to each other and that they're federated with one another. And then we also hope, while nobody else is obligated to do this, we fondly hope that others will be interested. So we know that we have some more sophisticated local water management entities out there who might choose to opt in voluntarily, observe our protocols, and make their data available and searchable through our portals and platforms. So this is what we hope to do. It's sort of a, I don't know, Tinker Toys keeps coming to mind, but it's this idea that just like the internet does for us today, searchability is really where the power is. And so that's what we're looking for. So obviously making the data available is part of the story, and making it play well with one another, interoperability, is the other part. So we are looking at these portals as tools to help our subject matter experts, those people who manage water and ecological resources in California, to address their own needs to answer questions. And we'll get into that in a moment. But really, again, the goal here is to maximize the value of data. Data is just loaded with potential power. And we love that we have that captured and that it's somewhere. But what we want to do is turn it loose and let more people look at it, again, in the spirit of transparency, but also because their inventiveness and their new way of looking at things, or the development of a new app that allows more people to see the results, is where the power is. So toward that end, we had worked with UC Water to develop a use case. This is actually their document. We're co-authors. I would love to encourage you, if you have any interest at all in this, you may want to look at this document. It's extremely readable. The one on the left is actually the narrative that explains about use cases. But in a nutshell, a use case is a brief examination of who needs what data, in what form, for what decision. So we start with the decision first. What are we trying to decide about? Are we trying to decide whether a program or project or grant was successful? Are we trying to decide if we can release more water today? Are we trying to decide whether a species is thriving or deteriorating? And so these are the kinds of questions we might ask, and then we back our way down into the data. So by looking at it that way, we expect that we are designing a system that is most focused on what a user needs. We also intend to on an ongoing basis, take into consideration user feedback. So, again, our focus is on usability of data to answer our questions. Questions that have been thought of and questions that we haven't even thought to ask yet. So we had in this experiment, if you will, in this early foray into the use case discussion, we had compiled or brought together a number of stakeholders who gave us some of their own thoughts based on their own work experience, their subject matter expertise. We developed or compiled 20 draft use cases. So qualifiers you need to understand. One, they are draft. They're not complete. Also, they are sort of exemplary. So those 20 are not meant to suggest that we've figured out what all the kinds of questions anyone will have to ask, or what all kinds of data, et cetera. But instead, what we're saying is that if you consider sort of on an XY axis, the number of use cases along the X axis and the number of requirements that it takes to make those use cases practical along the Y axis, we're sort of, if you will, asymptotically approaching a limit. So use case number 21 that we're to walk through the door isn't necessarily going to cause us to revisit and reconsider everything to do with the first 20 and what we learned there, but instead might add to that and cause us to maybe season it a little differently, if you will. So these 20 draft use cases just got us on the road to thinking about what functional requirements and business requirements we had to deal with, and those ultimately fed in to the Open Water Information Architecture document that I mentioned earlier. Now, so that's a lot of the footwork and the sort of methodical work, and then there is this notion of data challenges and test beds, which allow our stakeholders to get in there with us, roll up their sleeves, and help us understand how well we're doing. And in the process, they're also getting an opportunity to use these platforms and the data that are made available there in a way that might inspire new thinking, new visualizations, et cetera. So we had a safe drinking water data challenge that began in the spring of 2018. That's when it got going and folks were notified of its existence. But the activities, unlike most data challenges, went on through the summer all the way into a summit in October of 2018. And it was a really great process, partly because we had a lot of great support. We had people from West Big Data and Innovation Hub come out, and we had participation from Imagine H2O and a number of sponsors up there you'll see who worked really well together and also worked with those stakeholders, a lot of them students, by the way, not entirely, but a lot of them were students, to get them interested in the data and to think about what kinds of questions they could help answer. And so I'll show you a few examples of what we got out of that in a moment. But what I also wanted to highlight was I joined the data world about 2.5 years ago, and I had not been involved so much before that. And I'm still struck by how exciting a data challenge is to people who are into that sort of thing. It motivates a lot of energy and interest that I would never have predicted. But those are the kinds of things that it's exciting to be a part of, because you see that energy, that passion. I would actually, while I'm talking about passion, like to harken back to when I mentioned UC Water and UC San Diego and some of our stakeholders with the 20 draft use cases. What also has been striking to me as a newcomer to this world is the level of passion that people feel for data. I see that I have some believers up there on the dais, but excuse me, the passion that people feel for data is because of its potential and because of its ability to help us make better decisions. What's been great with the passage of AB 1755 is now we have a specific, item to line up behind. And so we're pushing further and faster than we ever have before, with a lot more people sort of lining up and shouldering the burden with us. And so that passion has, again, been remarkable to me and sort of energizing to me. But also, I want to make sure you understand that this is moving really well, largely because people care about it. So with that said, I'll show you a few examples from the Safe Drinking Water Data Challenge, and we'll talk just for a moment about the test bed, which is coming. Excuse me. This entry is just a screenshot because I didn't dare do a demo today live, but I would be happy to share with you all later the entries if you're interested. But the Safe Drinking Water Data Challenge was focused or rooted in the timely issue of the Human Right to Water Act. And it's something that a lot of people also, in addition to caring about data, also care about making sure that all of our Californians have access to clean and safe drinking water. And so this particular entry focused on the presence or absence, but mostly presence of lead in the San Francisco Unified School District schools. And so you'll see that the dots there, it's shown in yellow and sort of a gray and a red and an orange, are various levels of lead detected in water on specific school sites. And so if a person wanted to, they could click and highlight any school that they go to or that they know about and figure out what were the parts per billion. A qualifying statement that the entrant made that I want to pass along is that no level of lead is safe for children, but instead you can see that it goes from bad to substantially worse as the lead content goes up to 15 or more parts per billion. So, and that's what those red entries are, in case anyone's wondering. That's pretty serious. Another entry that we had is focused on domestic well vulnerability to drought, and this one was produced somewhat in partnership with PPIC. It's produced by somebody who's employed by them as a student, and he's done a lot of work. I would invite you again, if you're interested, I can share with you these entries. They're not yet available on the public website, but I'll be pushing on that. And this is, again, mostly a visualization tool. It's an opportunity for folks to answer questions for themselves about that vulnerability as we move into periods of shortage around the Central Valley. Again, what we've done here, though, is harness, with these two entries and 14 others, a lot of interest in data and solving safe drinking water data issues. So one of the other puzzle pieces that I didn't specifically call out when we were on that slide, but something that may also be fairly obvious if you've been around government for very long, you know that how we make decisions about what protocols we adopt or what data needs to be available or what technology we're going to adopt next, and also the funding it takes to make that happen, not just immediately and upfront, but over time. There is obviously a cost associated with making data available. We hope that we'll ultimately move toward it being sort of the way we do business for everyone, but that's going to be a long time out because of that legacy data I mentioned, the fact that folks are in established habits that they've been in for decades. And so we'll be moving in that direction for a very long time, but it will always cost something to make this available. So with that in mind, there is, again, adjacent to our activities, permitted by statute, but not necessarily called out as a requirement of statute, an exploration of governance and funding. So we've been fortunate, as I mentioned, to have partners all over the place, including philanthropy. So Water Foundation took up the cause and set up a contract with Redstone, which is a company out of Colorado. They have done outreach work and governance discussions in the past, and so we were fortunate to have their participation. They sat down with us and also some experts from around California and talked to them about what a governance structure would look like if we wanted to be resilient from one state government administration to the next, and how we might keep the funding flowing. And so this graphic you see here with the triangle is kind of just a characterization that I want to make sure I share with you so that you understand the basics. But literally, probably as we speak, there is an advisory committee assembling in Orange County right today for their second of three meetings to discuss this. And so that advisory council is essentially working with more expertise and one another to think about what specifically would this governance structure look like. This was, like I said, a model put forth back in May of 2018. So we're sharpening our pencils now, and we're starting to get a little bit more concrete about what that would look like. And they are essentially advising the state in how we might proceed. So this idea of a consortium, which is not unlike the IETF, which is the Internet Engineering Task Force, it which again we can say has been successful because the internet is still doing very well. But up at the top, the apex of this triangle, and they're all very important. It's not that any one is more important than the others, but up at the top we have the steering committee, which would be essentially policy people who would make decisions in consideration of what they learned from the other two groups about how data management in California would go forward, especially specifically with the relationship to water and ecological data. On the left, you'll see technical working groups, and those will be those data science experts that I was talking about, not necessarily limited to in California, but trusted technical experts. They would be advising on what's realistic and what's reasonable, technically speaking, what's possible. We also have on the right there use case working groups, and that's where people who are experts in the business of water management and water resources, ecological resources management would come and go with the idea that they are the drivers on what is needed. So they would, their feedback would come in through that corner or that triangle end, and then fuel conversation among the others. One last point on this slide that I want to highlight is you'll see up there too on the left across from the steering committee is a state governing group. We're not sure that it would look just like our partner agency team, but it may, and really what we want to get across is that there would be state agency representation at a sufficient level to make commitments and pursue funding and direct activities related to data. They would be still the implementers of AB 1755, but they'd be working in partnership with this consortium over here on the right that may or may not live within state service. So we've been encouraged so far the way it's going. There's a lot of openness, a lot of, like I said, healthy discussion, healthy debate. And so that meeting today will reveal some new developments, and they'll meet one more time officially in that capacity next month, and they'll make a recommendation to the state formally at that point. I will be happy to have discussion now, questions from you. You've all been very patient while I went on. So what can I answer for you? What thoughts
actually,
do you have?
That was great.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much. That was very clear, and I don't think the importance of what you were talking about was lost on anybody. I have some questions, but I'll turn to my fellow commissioners first. Commissioner.
Thank you very much for the presentation. It sounds like it's a very exciting time for you all, and this effort reminds me a lot of an effort that the Resources Agency tried to undertake in the late 1990s, early 2000.
Right.
It was a much broader effort. This is more focused on water resources and ecological values. But it sounds like you all are making a great effort, and for that I want to thank you and commend you.
Thank you.
Just, and maybe because of this kind of baggage I carry around, I was wondering, in terms of who the user groups are, I mean, is the information that's going to be available, is it anticipated to be used by those in the regulatory community, policymaking, land use decision makers?
Yeah. Okay. So first I want to just acknowledge, I suspect you're talking about Ceres, and I'm looking here to my colleague, David Harris from CNRA, who has joined us. And I'll invite him to come up and speak specifically to that point because I know he has thoughts on it, and he was an active member of the Ceres work and a strong believer in it. So I'm sure he'll have some thoughts for you too, but I'll also, if I can go back to my, okay, we'll go back to my presentation really quick. I'll just show you or call out one slide. I know you will have seen this before, but in case it's helpful, and I wish it were bigger, but this flower diagram, if you will, over here on the lower right. Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. The assists are wonderful. I want to hire you. excuse me, you can see over there on the left, we have a topic, an orb that has to do with water budgets, and then on the upper circle, water allocations and water, water supply. Thank you. And then on the right, we have water quality and beneficial uses. Thank you. And then down at the bottom, infrastructure investment. Right. And as you can see, that circle is probably the emptiest of them all, but it still has some presence there with about 4 use cases. This is just qualitative, of course, but our goal here was to sort of characterize the nature of those 20 draft use cases that we collected. And so some of them have to do with like daily operations, and some have to do with regulatory considerations. They might have to do, one of them had to do with, specifically it was about environmental stream flow. We had one, I was a part of the conversation. I was listening and enjoying it, not so much adding to it, but, you know, something to do with funding groundwater recharge under Prop 1. So there were a multitude of sectors that sort of come together there, and we recognize, again, that these 20 are just not even scratching the surface, but that there's room for all of our water management questions to be answered, supported by data. So every single question that we might ask could be supported by a use case that's essentially just a documentation of what people might already do anyway. Now, when we talk about that consortium and the use cases, again, the focus there will be driven not solely, but largely by this use case concept. If a person says, you know, I want to be able to answer question A or B or C, and when I go in there, that data is not available, or I understand that there are multiple sources and which one should I trust, or I would like to be able to, when I produce a result with that data, I'd like to be able to have version control, or what's the word I'm looking for, the address thing, the digital object identifier. So we recognize that there will be needs that we have not specifically addressed yet. We're aware of them, some of them. But what we hope will happen is that people will feel mobilized and come forward and say, I've got this use case, here it is, and these are the shortcomings of the system in response to it. So I'd like to see these improvements made. And then that consortium can consider them in a technical way, in a user demand way, and also on a policy level. So that's the goal. I hope that kind of gets a bit of an answer for you, and then I want to make sure that I let David speak to your point, too, about sure. Series.
So, and this is a very helpful slide, and I guess in my mind I was thinking from a regulatory standpoint, like a CEQA document, you know, that there would be I'm assuming there's information available or would be available on the platform that could be used in that kind of regulatory environment.
Yeah, I will let you talk. Sorry. Just really quick, I do want to respond a little bit more. I'll say that, yes, I think that that is a very reasonable hope and expectation. Publication of the data is really what 1755 focuses on, and therefore that's what we're focusing on in the early days. But I would venture a guess that a CEQA document probably isn't captured in any one use case, but a group of them. Right. And again, that means that they're all driven by and could be supported by different data sets or some overlapping. Another thing I'll say before I let David chime in is that we hope in the long run, and this is a hope, this is absolutely well outside of what 1755 requires of us, but what we hope we'll be able to do in the longer term is allow maybe some of those regulated reporters of data to maybe streamline their processes. Maybe they enter it in one place and it gets directed to the right place. So that's another potential value of data and potential value of this system that we're not promising, but we are sure excited about the possibility. So with that, David.
Okay. So the first step in an initiative like this is always inventorying the data that we've already got so it's findable, and that saves a lot of time. And for instance, it makes any kind of planning effort like CEQA or any of the others that we do easier.
But the second phase is where we start to work together to collaborate with that data and to integrate information. And I want to emphasize the power of use cases, and you know, this is a best practice in this kind of initiative, and the AB 1755 folks have embraced it heartily and gotten a really great benefit out of it. And so, for instance, speaking to your earlier question about what stakeholders would be involved, when you identify a list of your strategic questions or policy issues, which is another way of saying use cases, it gives all the stakeholders around that issue an opportunity to convene together to work on that together. And this effort's been remarkably productive and gone very quickly, and a lot of that is because of their intentionally cultivating the list of questions as well as cultivating the data.
Another question.
Go ahead.
Yeah. And this will be my last question. I noticed in the legislation that there's a requirement that recipients of state funds through grants and contracts, let's see, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but they're required, I guess, to feed into the database. And I was wondering at what point, from a timing standpoint, you know, what contracts and grants would be included in the database. And I'm kind of thinking along the lines of the Water Storage Investment Program, you know, whether or not information that will be captured, you know, would be a part of the database. And then also, is that just capturing information from grants and contracts that are executed by the departments that are participating in this effort? And if so, then I was just wondering, sorry, there's a whole bunch of questions in this. I didn't see that the Wildlife Conservation Board was included, and they do a lot of grants that, you know, like, for instance, their in-stream flow program will be, they fund a lot of studies on hydrogeologic studies in different watersheds. So I was just wondering if they were going to be captured in this database.
I'll just say a few things that are not not black and white, but I would like to first acknowledge the point you made. And in fact, I was, when I ran through my slides yesterday, I had jockeyed with the screenshots so many times, I was surprised that somehow that grant language didn't show up in there, and then I failed to mention it today. But it is something that we are cognizant of. I'll also mention that my background doesn't include anything to do with law or legal. And so I suspect that the interpretation, like whether this extends to other agencies or boards, is something that we need to get into and probably in the fairly near future. I will definitely rely on my compatriots here from your staff to chime in about the Water Storage Investment Program specifically, or any grant program specifically. I'd just like to say that we in the AB 1755 program do recognize this need, and we are expecting in the fairly near future to support a lot of grant programs in making those determinations and including appropriate language in their agreements. So we look forward to that, and we've had a little bit of conversation. Again, I will defer to them on this specific program and timing, but we stand ready to support that. And David had something to add as well.
Well, I just wanted to emphasize that the CNRA's open data platform is a set of tools that's available to all the programs and partners of Natural Resources Agency. So it includes a cataloging system, tools for integrating that data, and also tools for visualization, creating maps, graphs, dashboards, things like that. And so each program within CNRA can take advantage of those tools on its time frame according to its strategic priorities and can collaborate together across the organizational silos. So for each of those, it's a function of the priorities of those programs and organizations.
Okay. Did you have I think program staff can add a little bit more to your WISP okay. question.
Morning.
Good morning, Amy.
So with regards to the water storage investment program, as you know, we will be having these contracts for the administration of public benefits, and we will be working with the same agencies that Chris talked about in her presentation, Fish and Wildlife, Water Board, and DWR, and putting together these contracts for public benefits will likely identify any monitoring and data that could come out of these projects and that could be useful to be linked to this this platform. So we are aware of this requirement. We're willing to work with these the other agencies during this process. If you know this data does come up, we can easily work to put it on the platform.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm so glad you're both here and doing this presentation. I'll start with this, and that is that sometimes in the work that I get to do, I often tell folks that sometimes I feel like I'm privileged to be in the crow's nest of a ship and looking over the horizon. And really the story that you told this morning is that. And so I'm going to make a couple observations, and I think I have some questions in here. And one of them is, you know, when you talk about, you know, the public access and access to this open data really resource, one of the things that excites me very much is the opportunity that we will have to connect the public with their understanding of water supply. And, you know, one of the things that I've thought about when it comes to groundwater, as an example, is that that's completely abstract to most people. And the idea that, I mean, I like to imagine that sometime in the future, I'm going to be watching a weather report on TV, and they're going to say, oh, and by the way, here's where we are with our surface storage, and here's how much space we have in our groundwater. And maybe some other features that, you know, the groundwater should have been this, but right now we're at here. And so I am just struck by really the shift that this presents to the future with regards to public engagement as well as decision making. So it's really very exciting. And also, in looking at all the partners that you worked with, it's really heartening. The NGOs, certainly the academic, you know, communities, and I work with some of those folks, and I get to see their sincere excitement. And something that's also really important that comes up is with the work that you all are doing, one of the things that becomes clear are the gaps. It's like, where are the places where we need more information? And when you have that multitude of partners out there, including NGOs like the Water Foundation, and it's amazing that we have the new secretary who has been so involved with this in terms of the water world. It's really a fortune. And so I think about a lot of things, and, you know, for example, I know that there's been talk about the establishment of stream gauges around the state, which are really critical, not just for understanding what's happening with water there, but it's these little streams where an impact on that water supply can be devastating. And again, that informs local communities. It informs the folks who may want to try to use that resource and understand their impact. I was also struck when you talked about how, you know, the open data discussion really heated up during the drought. And I think what is equally important is the value of the open data when it comes to surplus. You know, and so this really creates a place where we can be looking at all of that now, and not just that emergency, but also in real planning. You know, and just lastly, I realize that I'm just making a bunch of statements here, but just the other day I was watching a public television program that was about water in the nation, and one of the things that I was really struck by was a visual which showed the Oglala groundwater aquifer and what it used to be 100 years ago and then what it is today. And I saw that and I thought, man, it would just be amazing for all these GSAs to be able to tell their customers and also their adjacent partners on whom they rely for water supply to be able to have that sort of visualization that comes from the work that you were doing. And really, it just is an incredible game changer in many areas. So really, I guess I'm saying a long thanks and acknowledgement for what you guys do. It's really important. Thank you so much. Are there any comments from the public? Come on up.
As someone who regularly accesses the hydrology data, my name is Deirdre Desjardins. I'm with California Water Research. And as someone who regularly accesses the hydrology data on the California Data Exchange Center, it would be very helpful if the full historical data was available. So if one is looking for long-term changes in the estuary or, changes in historical operations and impacts, or trying to correlate it with biological trends, having that historical data is just essential. And I've found in a lot of cases, it's not online anymore. We're unsure if we can get it. And another thing that would be very helpful is having tidally filtered data available as well. There's also some really important historical gauges like the Colusa Basin Drain, which is a major, major inflow to the Sac River and carries all the runoff from the rice farms. And that's really important. There's a lot of uncertainty about how much runoff there actually is, and it's a source of significant uncertainty in the CalSim model. And just getting that historical data and having it available, bringing gauges like that back online so that we can monitor it more in the drought. So anyway, if you had any comments about any of that, I'd appreciate it.
Thanks.
One of the great things about having a water data platform that's natural resources oriented in general is that when we look at the aggregation of all those use cases, they have functional requirements in common. And so that justifies investment in enhanced capabilities. And one of those that we see over and over is the importance of time series data. Mm-hmm. And so that's an area we're investing in more. And it'll be up to the programs that have that data. And, of course, going back, sometimes there's data gaps, unfortunately. But by having those programs be provided with a program that makes it much easier to manage their data and to make it available, we're much more likely to get all the value we can out of the data that already exists like that.
That's great. And actually, to the comments that you made and the questions that you raised, I think that the whole sector of grad students could be a place where you go with specific questions. And I think specifically about a particular report done by a woman from Davis. Her name is Allison Whipple. And she did this incredible report on the Delta. And it's everything from historical photographs, maps, salinity maps, and it's a comprehensive story which has both sort of data in it as well as a very readable and comprehensible document. So anyway, I think she raises a good point, but I would also suggest that, working with grad schools would be a good idea here to hone people in on those specific sites. It could be helpful. Are there any other questions or comments? Chris and David, thank you so much. Really very valuable. Really appreciate your work.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. We're going to just take a 10-minute break, okay? So a short recess here, okay? Thanks. Thanks again. All right, thanks. Okay, we'll reconvene the meeting and we'll go right into item number 11, which is the groundwater basin boundary modifications. So the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act and associated regulations allow local agencies to request changes to their basin boundaries. And GSAs, or groundwater sustainability agencies, were formed in 2017, and subsequently some GSAs have requested basin boundary modifications prior to developing their sustainability plans or GSPs. DWR has completed its review of the 43 modifications requested in 2018 and issued its draft decisions on January 4th. SGMA requires the Commission to hear and comment on DWR's draft decisions on revised boundaries. Today, we have several staff from DWR here to brief us on the basin boundary modification process and results, and Deputy Director Taryn Ravazzini will lead off, and then Dane Matthews, supervising engineer, engineering geologist with SGMA, will go through the program, and there's another person, David and Tim, also with this office, will be presenting. Good morning, Taryn. Welcome.
Good morning, Commissioners.
Happy New Year.
All right, I'll try to. There we go. Well, first off, congratulations to the newly elected chair and vice chair. On behalf of the department, I would like to thank you both for your leadership over this past year and the years before, and we look forward to continuing to work with you in your leadership roles. I and members of the Executive Sustainable Groundwater Management Program are before you today to present the department's process for and draft decisions of the 2018 groundwater basin boundary modifications. Presenting before you today is an important part of DWR's public review and finalization process. The project team is led by Dane Mathis. Dane is the chief of the Groundwater and Regional Planning Branch, and that is out of our South Central Regional Office. And he will be providing the main presentation, but first I did want to set the stage a little bit for you all. Since SGMA was enacted in 2014, the department has worked closely with the Water Commission in the development of regulations to guide SGMA implementation, including for basin boundary modifications. And we have greatly appreciated the public forum offered by the Commission meetings and the input that has been provided by commissioners to date. It does amaze me that it's already 2019. This, I believe, is our 23rd or 24th presentation before the Commission since the passage of SGMA. And as you well know, the team has been working quite diligently and rather tirelessly to get things up and running. And basin boundary modifications, in fact, are one of several major deliverables for the department this first half of 2019. As you well know, SGMA is a long-term endeavor. This is a complete shift in how we've been looking at groundwater management. And there are a lot of foundational components that we have needed to set up since its passage. Sustainability doesn't happen overnight. The legislature gave local agencies 20 years to reach sustainability from the time they submit their groundwater sustainability plans. But there is an enormous amount of work being done both at the local and state levels to support local entities with those plans, with development of those plans. Basin boundaries are foundational to SGMA because they define the area to be managed. This is, in fact, the second round of basin boundary modifications since the regulations were adopted. The first round was conducted in 2016, and we came before the Water Commission then as well, and that was in accordance with the regulations to present on the modifications and hear from the Commission and receive additional public input. This was a successful exchange, and we are pleased to be back again for the second round. Modifications to basin boundaries are solely at the request of local agencies, and it's an important component to local management. Basin boundary modifications provide the opportunity to request modifications to better define basins for the purpose of sustainable groundwater management implementation. So this really is the starting line for SGMA. This is, or the SGMA marathon, as some have called it. We're all learning together, and we will be adaptively managing as we go along. This second round of modifications was open for local agencies for more than 1 year, beginning July 1, 2017, and closing on September 28, 2018. It should be noted that there's a considerable amount of work that has to be done by the local agencies before even bringing their submittal to the department. And then from that point, the department does go through a considerable amount of technical review, rather in-depth review, and it has required quite a good group of team members for the, from the Sustainable Groundwater Management Program, and I really want to extend my thanks to all of them for not only working very hard on that, but also working very closely with the local submitting agencies. Just to give you a little more context on where this falls in the programmatic timeline, first, GSPs, or groundwater sustainability plans, are due January 31st, 2020 for critically overdrafted basins. So that is 12 months and 15 days from now. 2022 for remaining high and medium priority basins. Plans must be complete and cover the entire basin, either individually or in coordination with multiple plans. Commissioner Quintero mentioned basin prioritization, and that is a connected component with basin boundary modification. But basin boundary modifications must happen prior to finalizing prioritization for the 59 basins that are involved in this process and or affected by this process. We, however, did release the final prioritization for 458 basins not impacted by the modifications we will be discussing today. That was finalized on January 4th of 2019. So the second step of prioritization will be addressed after we have this meeting and finalize the basin boundary modifications, and therefore it's targeted for late spring of 2019. I just want to thank you again for your time. I'll turn this over now to Dane Mathis and the team to provide the official presentation. Thank you, commissioners.
Thank you, Tor.
Thank you. Thank you, Tarn. And thank you. Good morning, Chair Quintero, Vice Chair Baker, Commissioners, Officer Yun, and staff. Really appreciate you hosting the department once again, especially in this timeline that we're at this project. I think we have a very successful project, and it's due to teamwork, as you mentioned in the opening remarks. And it's just wanted to introduce to make sure you knew that we have Tim Godwin with the Sustainable Groundwater Management Program, and Chris Alvera out of our South Central Region office, two of the very key members of this project, very helpful. But it wasn't them on their own. There were a group of 10 other key team members that are helped within our other region offices within our Division of Integrated Regional Water Management. So I know we've provided very detailed briefing materials. So if you could just indulge me with going through a bit of background information in support of our projects and our draft decisions. And I just want to go through some of the key items to touch upon, just because they're common themes that will come back on some of these requests and related to a lot of the comments that we received on our draft decisions. So just a bit of background, the department's had the authority and been investigating the state's alluvial groundwater basins and reporting on those for over 60 years. The first report came out in 1952. Subsequent reports are officially published in Bulletin 118, and the last full version was in 2003 before SGMA was signed. And our latest version is an interim update in 2016, and that was done after the mentioned 2016 round of basin boundary modifications. So with respect to the Act actually applies to all of the 500-plus groundwater basins identified in Bulletin 118. So that's a key component as well. And, of course, as you know, it's the high and medium priority basins that are subject to the requirements to prepare plan. Within the Act, there was a process for, now, beyond the department doing its own investigations, there's a process for local agencies to make requests that culminated in the department's responsibility to develop the regulations. And, of course, as you know, we did those in 2015 and were before the commission several times to get your valuable input. and to eventually adopt those regulations. And just a key on the purpose today, again, it's a hear and comment function from the commission, although the commission does not have an approval role for the department's decisions on basin boundaries. Again, we do value your input, and that was certainly notable during the 2016 round. Now, some key things here, some key terms that we need to talk about are basin and aquifer. Basins are generally, the external boundaries are based on science and presumably the best available science that we have. Within the definition of basin, it's reflective of one or more aquifers that have defined boundaries. And then we have to, and these are definitions out of the regulations that were developed. And the aquifer is very important because it refers to sedimentary rock or alluvial sediments that can produce significant and economic quantities of groundwater. So a basin in itself is not necessarily defined by, say, the land use, whether or not there may or may not be wells or productive wells within the material. It's not necessarily defined by the presence of a stream channel or perhaps habitat. And just reflective of subbasin, that's generally a subdivision of a basin, internal boundary that can reflect jurisdictional or institutional boundaries such as a county line or a water district boundary. And we're getting into, off of the background information and into more details of the project itself, everything is done online. So it's not a paper submittal that comes into the department and sits in somebody's cubicle for review, but this is part of our basin boundary modification request system. It's on our SGMA portal, along with the other items related to SGMA, the alternative submittals, the GSA submittals. Eventually, it'll be housed the groundwater sustainability plan submittals. So an important thing to know about this is an opportunity for an agency to notify the public that they're considering making a modification request. That's a notice and consultation period. And it's also when they finally formally decide to make a request, they upload all of the information and it becomes readily available to the public for review and comment. The Basin Boundary Modification Request System is also where the department makes all of our communications with the requesting agencies in terms of if they've supplied something that doesn't quite meet the regulations, we can use the communication tool, and that's part of the record for that. Excuse me. And just to go over a few types of modification categories, there's generally scientific or jurisdictional. And when you talk about a scientific revision, it's generally an external boundary, but it can be an internal boundary based on a hydrogeologic barrier or some other groundwater divide, perhaps. And the internal lines, which we saw quite a bit of on this round of modification request, is bumping that internal basin boundary or sub-basin boundary, perhaps from a river to a county line or maybe off of a county line and covering a district that would make a district or other agency wholly within one basin instead of two. Another types of examples, and certainly we got a few of these on this round, are basin consolidation. So that's where we're the agency's requesting that an internal basin boundary gets dissolved or removed, and therefore it creates a larger area of a basin, not necessarily by footprint, but two basins in one, so to speak. And we also received three requests this round for basin subdivision, and that's where we agency is requesting an existing basin or subbasin be subdivided into smaller parts, creating more lines within basins. So on to the 2018 project. Again, this is the second round from 2016. The opportunity for public agencies to submit their initial notifications. Again, this is just letting the public know that they're considering a request. It's not necessarily committing, but that started back July 1 of 2017. The official submission period opened January 1, and it went through September 28. Our first request came in May. Most of our requests came the last week of September, which is fine. Technical review teams were ready and willing to get started on the reviews. Just a breakdown of the request. I talk about the types of categories. We did receive 43 individual requests from agencies. 23 of those were jurisdictional, 15 were scientific, and 5 of those were actually a combination of both jurisdictional and some scientific modifications. The map itself just shows highlights in red and yellow the extent of requests that came into the department. We did get quite a breadth of changes with respect to scientific revisions. So think of a very large basin, but an agency requesting an update to only a small segment of it. And also similar to jurisdictional requests, something very simple as changing a small segment from center of river line to county versus more wholesale updates of consolidations as we saw in the northern Sac Valley. So after the end of September, the team were very busy conducting all of our technical reviews, getting our thoughts together, and coming together as a department, releasing our initial draft decisions on November 29th. At that time, we had a total of 33 come out approved, 7 were denied, and 3 were approved, but within those requests, there were portions of it that didn't quite meet the regulations, so that's what deny portion means for those particular 3. In public comment opportunity, there's plenty of it for this particular project and the way it works. But as mentioned by Ms. Ravazzini, that really starts at the local level. The agency's notice and consultation activities generally include identifying all of the stakeholders, the interested parties, holding the required meetings. With respect to basin subdivision, agencies actually have to secure confirmed support from all agencies and all water systems in all of the affected basins that they're wanting to modify. So in some cases, that could be a pretty high bar to meet. Beyond the local agency's work, which is very important because the general expectation is that the agency collects all of that input and hopefully gets the support and comes to the department without opposition. Not necessarily a requirement, but I think that's the general take. Once the agency submits it to the Basin Boundary Modification Request System and the department marks it complete, that again opens up another 30-day comment period opportunity for the public to comment on the agency's request. And a little bit different now than we switch to the department releasing our draft decisions. That's an opportunity for the public to comment on the department's draft decisions. We had a 30-day plus period that went from end of November to just January 4th, recently closed. And that also included the public meeting that we held December 11th in this very same room, which we collected for not many, but 4 public comments at that time, important. And the last opportunity for public comment, of course, is here today, although it's here in comment focus between the department and the commission. It's an agendized item, and so the public has opportunity to comment. So just a quick something happened with the formatting, but nonetheless, I think we can verbalize this on the slide. This is just focused on the comments received on the department's draft decisions. And so I think about just giving you a few examples. I look at Shasta Valley on the left that had a total of 13 comments. When we released our draft decisions, Shasta Valley was denied. And so the comments in orange are reflected of opposition to the department's draft decision of denies. It's generally reflective of local support wanting some approval of the local agency's request. And another example is the South American consumeness bar there over on toward the right. There's a mix of support and opposition, and that was reflective of similar comments that we received during our December 11th public comment period. So the public comment period, as I mentioned, just ended January 4th. We actually received 3 clarifying comments on 3 of the requests, and we'll talk about those in some additional slides. So we did a fairly quick but nonetheless thorough review of the additional information, and we had some adjustments to our draft decisions, which we just shared with the commission on Monday, and we also shared with the public with updating our website. So the numbers now are 35 approve, 4 deny, and 4 approve with deny portion. And again, I do have slides in the presentation to highlight those three changes that were made. And I mentioned also that the summary table, updated table of our draft decisions and updated information is all on our department's Space and Boundary website. So just to get on a few notable boundary modifications, there are actually just two out of the four denials for our recent draft decisions. The first one is a submittal by the Northern Delta Groundwater Sustainability Agency. I need to take a little bit of time to explain the graphic on this slide because it shows up in some other slides. What you're looking at is the yellow line in the middle portion of the graphic is representing where the basin line is today. And the red line and the shape in the middle is what the requesting agency was looking for. And this request was actually a subdivision. It's a subdivision of three individual basins. And the agency secured support, but the support for the subdivision was only focused on the agencies that were within their new proposed basin. So they did not meet that specific requirement in the regulations to get three-quarter support from all agencies and all water systems in the affected basins. You can imagine there would be hundreds of them for this particular scenario. So we could go to another request by the Slough House Resource Conservation District. This is the example that I mentioned briefly on the comments summary slide. So this Slough House RCD came in with just an internal jurisdictional modification. Again, the yellow line is where the basin lines are today, so you can imagine the request generally involves the expansion of the Consumnes Basin on the south into the south, to the north, into the southeast part of the South American subbasin. This request, on the agency's request, they did have some opposition, both from the Sacramento Central Groundwater Authority and the City of Sacramento. And then, as shown on the previous bar graph slide, our draft decision to deny also had comment. Of course, the representative from Slough House RCD was opposing DWR's decision to deny it, but then Sacramento Central Groundwater Authority was continued to support DWR's decision to deny it. Oh, I'm sorry, I needed to look at my notes here. Just in general, the main rationale to deny it, we have it on this slide, is did not appear to support sustainable groundwater management. That's one of the elements in the regulations that allows the department as a basis for denial for the request. In summary, there's local disagreement really on what needs to be managed and how. And the thinking was it's not up to the department to make that call. It's really the local agencies that should come together, work together locally. You know, it's needs to work together towards meeting the requirements of SGMA, certainly, but maybe to come back to the department at a later time when they can show general agreement with each other. And just touch upon the three updated draft decisions. The first one is for a small, very small portion of the Paso Robles area subbasin. This request came from Heritage Ranch Community Services District. So the graphic on the left, you can see the circle and the yellow line work. It's just a small alluvial channel that drains into the main part of the basin. The initial request wasn't quite clear about the connectivity of that portion to the aquifer that defines the basin. And the requesting agency subsequently provided supporting information to the department where we were agreeable and so revised our draft decision to approve. Another updated draft decision was for a submittal by West Kern Water District for the Kern County subbasin. Most of the requested boundary modification change is an external boundary that would essentially remove, exclude the significant oil-producing areas. So these are areas you think of that are somewhat anomalous within a basin. They're not quite pieces of bedrock that stick out in the center of the basin, but nonetheless, it's kind of based on a different type of land use going on. We came out as with our draft decision of initially to deny the request because it wasn't clear about the level of connectivity of these areas potentially had with what's considered locally the main aquifer of the basin. The agency submitted their additional technical comments during the period. Again, we did another round of reviews on the additional clarifying information. We did change our draft decision a little bit, but not the portion to approve the removal of the anticlines and the oil field areas. The approval was mostly for the perimeter older alluvial units and some older rock, fractured rock or rock units that we know are not indicative of aquifer material per the regulations. And the last example here is for Shasta Valley. This was a request by Siskiyou County Flood Control and Water Conservation District. And notably, the initial request was very thorough. They had quite a few technical studies to demonstrate their proposed expansion of Shasta Valley, if you could see it lightly in that yellow shade on the left-hand graphic. So this is quite a large expansion to the east from the existing basin. And they demonstrated a thorough knowledge of the groundwater pumping in the area, the land use, and these volcanic deposits that they had presented. One thing that was missing was that the data, the confirmation that the volcanic deposits actually met the definition of aquifer in the regulations. And again, that needs to be reflective of sediments or sedimentary rock that produced economic quantities of groundwater. And this was, again, another opportunity the agency provide clarifying information. And again, it was fairly thorough. They looked at up to 1,300 or so well logs. So these are logs demonstrating what the subsurface conditions are like in these expanded areas into the volcanic deposits. And they were to successfully show that there was a predominant presence of sediments and sedimentary material, although it's interspersed within these sequence of volcanic deposits that contribute and make up and define the basin that they're wanting to modify. And so that updated draft decision is approved by the department. So once again, just a final slide here before we go to any comments or questions, but our updated draft decisions as of Monday, out of the 43 requests, we approved 35 of those, deny 4, and 4 of those we approve with only portions deny. As Taryn mentioned, the final modifications are on track to go February next month. And with that, I just thank you again for your time and your input and be happy to address any questions you have. And certainly I might look to the other key staff to address any questions.
Thank you very much. That was an excellent presentation. And just for clarification, so the ones that were denied, they're going back to the drawing board, and what is the date by which they have to come back to you, or is that
no? The 2018 cycle is done. We had our public comment period, and that was the opportunity for agencies to submit additional clarifying information on our draft decisions that were released at the end of November. So they had from, not a long period, but 30-plus days to gather up some additional information. Other than that, we mentioned we're on a pretty tight schedule to solidify boundaries, prioritization, and kind of get things settled out so agencies can plan.
Yeah, I'm just asking for clarification. Okay. Do any other commissioners have questions on this? That was very good. It's curious to me just the jurisdictional and scientific boundaries. That's a real that's a real juggle. And I think about the amount of work that you and your team have had to do with Sigma, and as Taryn said, 21 presentations, and I remember most of them. it's been a tremendous amount of work for what seems like a really small team to me. So I hope that you have the resources to continue the important work that you're doing, and very much appreciate your comments about Sigma being about locally controlled aquifers and basins, you know, and the attention that you paid to that in your decisions. That's a tough juggle. We have one public comment, so you might want to stay there in case there's an answer to a question. This is Hans Peter Walter, and he's with the Slough House Resource Conservation District. Good morning.
Good morning, Commissioners. Thank you for hearing me. Just wanted to add a few public comments and take this opportunity to introduce this issue to the Commission. Slough House Resource Conservation District and Omichomi-Hartnell Water District, which jointly supported the boundary change, are public agencies, local public agencies in Sacramento County, established in the 1950s to represent and organize rural agricultural landowners in the central southern portion of Sacramento County. Essentially, for those of you who are local, the land south of Grantline Road, and actually they call it Grantline Road because the lands we're talking about were originally Spanish land grants, Mexican land grants, Rancho Omichominas and Rancho Cosumnes. The agencies requested the jurisdictional change to consolidate the local agencies, Slough House and Omichomi-Hartnell Water District, into one basin. The situation now is that the basin line runs through the Cosumnes River, and it splits Omichomi-Hartnell Water District essentially in half and splits off a portion of Slough House Resource Conservation District, which is a much larger district, close to 100,000 acres, but again, about 15-20% of it is in the South American subbasin, while the rest is in the Cosumnes subbasin in Sacramento County. DWR's tentative denial found that resource groundwater management would not be improved or facilitated. That's kind of a subjective call that we disagree with, and they also pointed out that there was opposition. I'd like to quickly address those issues. In terms of improving groundwater management, the change on jurisdictional grounds was primarily to allow Slough House and Omichomi, two local districts that really have limited resources, as you may be familiar with a lot of agricultural, more rural local agencies, allow them to focus on the Cosumnes subbasin, all the resources in one subbasin, instead of having to divide their resources into the two. So we think that will improve resource management in the Cosumnes, allowing these two agencies that comprise more than half of the surface area of the basin on the Cosumnes subbasin. Secondly, it will be improved by aligning similar land use, landowners, etc., that are north of the river but within the riparian corridor of the river, within the same governance structure of more local representative public agencies that are more aligned with the rural agricultural landowner base versus the South American subbasin, which is an urban-dominated basin, and the GSAs there, the opposition here from the City of Sacramento, the Sacramento Central Groundwater Authority, these are predominantly urban-dominated interests. And we think there will be friction, less buy-in, and possibly disputes, which is not what you want. We would urge, to conclude my comments, we'd urge that the Commission look at this issue. The opposition here is solely in the self-interest of the urban agencies who are looking to impose kind of their will as far south as they can, and we would urge the Commission, if it so is inclined, to support the comments of Slough House, the desires of Slough House and Omichomi for true local control, and make recommendations to the department to reverse its decision. And I'm here to answer any questions about it, and am free to work with any commissioners and staff if you're interested in looking into the issue more.
Thanks. The situation that we face is that the prioritization decisions, which were released on January 4th, were the final decisions. And so what's happening today is your public comments become a part of the record, but right now we're not going to be making any changes. Go ahead.
Is that accurate? I thought you still can.
Right. So I just want to clarify, he is commenting on a basin boundary mod. The commission does have the capacity to comment to DWR on the basin boundary mods, so that he's not talking about a prioritization that was previously decided.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
It's okay.
So do we have any comments from other commissioners? Go ahead, Commissioner Byrne.
Yeah, thank you for coming. So I am, I guess, just curious to get a little more detail on what the opposition was from the city and whether the judgment call was one about groundwater management or was it also influenced by, hey, you guys need to figure this out before we're going to do something in which we have jurisdictions that are fighting, or both?
There we go. Sorry. Yeah, just to clarify that the modification request is reflective of an area that of the basin that, as Hans-Peter points out, is under the jurisdiction of Omichumney-Hartnell and Consumnes Resource Conservation District, or I'm sorry, Sluhus Resource Conservation District. These entities are also party to the South American Central Groundwater Management Agency. This region is also in conflict over GSA and how this is going to be managed. And so there's a series of layers of complexity about how this is going to be managed moving forward. And the department's opinion is that we want to echo the sentiment within SGMA that this is best managed locally. And so without local resolution about how these areas are going to be managed and resolved, because regardless of where the boundary modification is, they're going to have to coordinate in some capacity to manage that region. We can't weigh in to say that one is better than the other in this case in terms of how this is going to move forward to management. We really want to defer to locals to resolve these situations before we can act. That said, you know, we've heard from this request in 2016. At that point in time, the county specifically refuted or opposed the modification request, and that has a specific line item within our regulation. This time around, the county did not. The county is also signatory to the Groundwater Authority, although that doesn't trigger, in our opinion, that specific line item within the regulation to reject that. So it really reverts back to whether or not there has been a demonstration that the resulting condition would improve groundwater sustainable management moving forward. And the fact that the conflict still exists over a number of years and there really hasn't been any sort of action towards resolving that, we felt it best to let it remain as such so locals can resolve this and move forward with planning as SGMA gets implemented.
Commissioner Keg.
Thank you.
So I'm the slide on page 16, Bree, if that's possible. And I'm sorry for my confusion about this. So the yellow line that's on there is the proposal, right? So is that land currently in some other basin? Is this increasing the amount of basin?
No, that's an excellent question, and I think it just helps to clarify the graphic itself. So what you see is a yellow depicted basin of the South American subbasin to the north,
okay,
and the Consumnes subbasin to the south. You can see a yellow line in the middle there. So effectively, north of that yellow line is the South American subbasin.
Oh, I see.
And south is the Consumnes. And so what's being proposed is that, as Hans-Peter points out, that the revised red line you see north of into the South American encompasses the Sluhus Resource Conservation District and Omichumney-Hartnell's jurisdictional boundaries.
Okay.
And that is a course of action that has been leveraged throughout the state in terms of jurisdictional modifications, and we've supported those. But those have been supported because there is lack of opposition.
Got it. Thank you.
Another way of saying that is that yellow line is the scientific boundary. Or is that accurate?
Yeah, it's an internal boundary, and it was based on hydrology as Hans-Peter points out. Mm-hmm. But effectively, it being internal, that one in particular is based upon science. It's a hydrologic boundary.
Well, yeah. I hate to jump in. It's along the river. So yeah. To the extent, again, Dane's earlier statements about what is a basin, I'm not a hydrogeologist, but it's along the Cosumnes River. So the water goes to the left, to the right. You could view it all as one basin, I assume. That's the border. It's a river right now. So they're very closely, I think north and south, very closely related to the river.
So how did the yellow boundary come to be? I'm trying to understand this. I'm actually pretty familiar with the Cosumnes Basin and the Upper American, so I'm familiar with that area, but go ahead.
Sure. So Bulletin 118 basin boundaries have evolved through a number of iterations of that document. In 2003, which is the document adopted by SGMA to define these basins, that was a significant change in how these basins were subdivided, and this basin in particular being the Greater Sacramento Valley Basin, being subdivided into a series of sub-basins. Those sub-basins were divided along, as we point out, rivers and other jurisdictional boundaries where appropriate. So in general, what was done was we utilized rivers to define those boundaries. Many of the modifications that we've had come in have chosen to revert those to more jurisdictional boundaries for the purposes of complying with SGMA requirements, formation of GSAs, and management moving forward. Often these jurisdictional boundaries follow the rivers similarly. Does that
go ahead?
Clarify it for you?
Commissioner Byrne, yeah, did that help?
And I'm sorry if we're going over territory that we've already traveled, but so this is not necessarily a scientific adjustment request. It's more of a jurisdictional one. And I get the concern about the fact that you're split in half and all that.
Yes.
But I am sympathetic, but I do kind of get the concept on a jurisdictional one. And I'm, I think, in sync with kind of leaving it more to the locals to figure out where if there's a clear scientific one where it doesn't make sense, or maybe there's a finger of something that is, you know, an area that is an island or on its own and doesn't make sense to be included. But in this kind of situation, I tend to think I'd want to have you guys figure it out, although I understand being the smaller party going up against the big city. Not to say I know anything about it to know who's on the right or wrong side or if there even is one, but that's just my thought.
No, thanks. I agree with what you just said. You know, I think that I'm thinking out loud here. So part of what we're looking at here is a situation where the two agencies are going to have to work it out and see how this works, and at some future date come forward with a management strategy.
Yes, that can be in a number of different methods or modes, if you will. Currently, there's an alternative plan submitted for the South American Basin, and so pending the department's determination on that, that may prompt renewed discussions about how this is managed moving forward. There's the requirement to update the alternative plan should it be approved, and if not approved, then there's the requirement to develop a GSP, both of which require additional coordination to manage these basins moving forward. As Tarn pointed out early on, we're at the starting line for SGMA, and this is going to be a process and take some time, and it's going to take a lot of effort and coordination amongst local agencies to resolve how best to manage these basins. If I might add, you know, this isn't without precedent. There has been similar disputes in 2016. There was a basin in San Joaquin Valley, which had opposition regarding the jurisdictional modification request, and they were able to resolve this through a coordination agreement. A local, they didn't need to provide that to us, but something that they said, hey, we resolved this way, and we, based on this agreement, we're withdrawing our opposition to this request. Something like that could be very functional in a situation like this where, okay, we can understand that you have a pathway forward that you're both able to work with, and that the opposition would be removed. That'd be something we could support. But frankly, that did not occur in this case and hasn't since 2016.
So in that example that you gave in 2016, was that something that they came to you and said, what are some of our options here, or did they come up with that solution?
During the initial reviews, they said they were working on it, and they asked us to delay and wait, and frankly, we couldn't. We were on a timeline that we needed to advance this project, and they ended up coming in with that withdrawal of opposition actually after our first presentation to the Commission of our draft results, and we came back to you and resolved that as one of those items.
Okay. I'm quick. Go ahead, Commissioner Byrne.
So just quick follow-up. So what's the threshold for, I mean, if there's any opposition from other local agencies, do we just kind of step away? Or it does seem that there would be some very common sense situations where the department might want to make a determination in spite of opposition if it was minor, maybe.
Right. No, thank you. That's great. The regulations actually provide some clarity there in that we are looking to affected agencies. So in this case, Sacramento Central Groundwater Authority is an affected agency. Their jurisdiction is within that area being modified. The planning process, the group as a whole is within that area and adjacent to it, as well as Slough House and Consumnis. An agency, say, outside of that, without that line directly impacting them, they would not be an affected agency necessarily. And so an opposition from them may not have the weight that something like this does. So, yeah, there are varying degrees of which voice is loud in this instance, and it's defined as the affected agency.
So affected agencies, then our policy is to not necessarily do a jurisdictional change unless there's more consensus or total consensus, it sounds like.
I wouldn't go as far as to say total consensus. We are paying very close attention to the comments we've received from not only the agencies but the public in this instance. There are public comments as well that weighed in here on both sides. So we're paying very careful attention to the input we're receiving from external of this submission request as well. So
okay, and ultimately, I guess that finding of improved groundwater management is what you're hanging your hat on. So regardless of whether there's some opposition, you could still, if you looked at it and someone was being very unreasonable, make a decision.
Yes.
Okay.
Dane, did you want to comment on this? Okay. I wasn't sure if you were waiting in the wings. Okay. All right. So it looks like there's some work ahead.
There is. I appreciate the commission hearing and allowing me to introduce the circumstances, and we will continue to try to work it out.
Thank you.
There may be other issues that we come up to, and now you're somewhat familiar with it if we can't or if other issues come up. So, again, I appreciate the time.
It's a really important area, so I appreciate the complexity of that and the difficulty that you guys have in getting a plan together. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Dane, do you want to make any comments?
Well, just confirming there's no more public comment. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay. Just up here again, just hopefully closing it out. But that's your job,
that's
not mine.
That's where we're at.
Thank you again. We really value your input from the commission. I really appreciate it. We look forward to moving along with this project as well as the others in our near-term horizon for the department.
Well, I'll say again in a different way that I think that the groundwater team has just done a Herculean effort on all of the work in California and all the various groups that you've had to work with. And just, you know, we've gotten glimpses into some of the issues that you've had to deal with, but certainly not a full appreciation of how hard you all have been working. And so thank you. And if there are no more comments with that, thanks to all four of you.
Thank you.
Taryn, Tim, Dane, and Chris. thanks for all your work, and thanks for your presentation today. All right, thanks. Okay, we'll move on to item 12, which is the consideration of items for the next California Water Commission meeting. In February, we're planning on having a presentation by the Climate Registry on Energy and Water Nexus, and we'll also have a briefing on the Model Water Efficiency Landscape Ordinance, a WSIP update, and we'll be considering DWR's fee regulations for the Division of Safety of Dams. Is there anything else or any questions from the commissioners? Commissioner Byrne?
I mentioned it to the executive officer, but at some point, when it's ripe, I'd be curious to get a briefing on the San Joaquin flow restrictions that are being considered by the state board.
That sounds like a good idea.
Okay. Got it.
All right. I think we're at the end of the program here, so I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Do we have a second? All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you, everybody, and thanks for the public and all the staff that are here today.